Welcome to the Stinging Fly podcast. My name is Nicole Flattery. The Stinging Fly has been publishing new writers and new writing for the past 25 years. We take a particular interest in promoting the short story, and for this podcast, we ask a writer to root around our archive and pick out a story to read and discuss with me here. On this month's episode, I'm joined by novelist and writer Jan Carson, who has chosen to read from Sheila Armstrong's story, Harlow. Harlow was published on the Stinging Fly website in November 2021. Jan Carson is a writer and community arts facilitator based in Belfast. Her first novel, Malcolm Orange Disappears, was published in 2014, followed by a story collection, Children's Children, 2016, and two postcard stories anthologies. Her second novel, The Fire Starters, in 2019, won the EU Prize for Literature and was shortlisted for the Dalkey Novel of the Year Award. The Raptures was shortlisted for the Unpost Novel of the Year and the Kerry Group Novel of the Year. Her work has appeared in numerous journals and on BBC Radio 3 and 4. She won the Harper's Bazaar Short Story Competition and has been shortlisted for the BBC National Short Story Award, the Unpost Irish Short Story of the Year, and the Sean O'Fallon Short Story Prize. Jan's writing has been widely translated. Her short story collection, Quickly, While They Still Have Horses, is forthcoming in spring 2024. Jan is a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature. Jan recently contributed to this so-called Writing Life, a series of essays reflecting on craft, process, and the pains and pleasures of writing and publishing, published on the Stinging Fly website. Hi, Jan.
Hi, Nicole.
I really like that title, your story collection.
Yeah, it's quirky. That's the story, actually, that was published in the Stinging Fly. Oh. So it's the title story of the collection.
I look forward to it. So you chose Sheila Armstrong's short story, Harlow. And I'm going to ask you to read from it for a little while, but do you want to tell us what this story is about?
Yeah, it's a quirky little story. I was drawn to it because I like monkeys, and it's a story about monkeys. And it kind of threw me a little bit as well. I'm actually going to read from near the end of it. So just to give you a little bit of context, the chief protagonist is a guy whose mother worked on a kind of sanctuary where she was followed around by a baby monkey. And when she discovers she's pregnant with him, she has to leave. So there's this kind of theme in his life where he feels like his mother was always drawn between who she loved more, him or the monkey, which I think is something we can all kind of relate to. So I'm going to read the last couple of pages. I don't think you really need much more explanation. Yes. In his mother's Roanoke house, Mark sorted through oceans of books, assorted gardening supplies, old editions of The New Yorker, a badly folded tent, three antique fur coats, an incomplete set of billiard balls, trips of ceramic ornaments, and boxes of photographs. In one box he found faded Polaroids of his mother in the rainforest. Long, loose hair, a swollen belly peeping out from under a crop top, an ocelot cub at her feet, a parrot on her shoulder, and a baby monkey slung around her hip. So that much of the story was true. But whether this was the monkey, he would never know. In another photo, Kodak this time and yellow-hued, his middle-aged mother was holding up both hands splayed out, with rings on each finger. One for each lost love was written on the back. Although considering her penchant for dramatics, it was as likely to be true that the rings were tin and glass, or were scavenged from an upturned gumball machine. None of the men in her life could be counted as loves, he considered, or even lost. More mislaid, like a useful but inessential trolley token. At least the ones he knew about. There had been some men that she had cried over, and others who were chased out of the house, including, on one memorable occasion, a lover who escaped just ahead of the wild swings of a replica didgeridoo. A good-natured friend had even lived with them in Barcelona for a year when Mark was 13. The man had painted his own fingernails blue at the kitchen table every Sunday morning, filling the house with the sharp scent of acetone. His mother had fancied herself a journalist that year and had disappeared for large chunks of time, always returning with a token for him, a colourful bus ticket, an unfamiliar candy brand, a straw figurine. He forced himself to stop looking through the photographs after an hour. He couldn't understand how much of her was compressed into each one. They were angry, caged things, even though she was smiling in most of them. On a roof in Lisbon, Maria Rosa tells him to shut up, that she hates monkeys because their long fingers look like spoons. He can't argue with that, so he goes down on her instead, spelling out the alphabet with his tongue and stopping on the letter she likes best. His mother couldn't remember the monkey's name. That's what annoyed him the most. He found very little trace of himself while clearing the house in Roanoke, which made him feel equal parts wounded and smug. He revised and reworked what he would tell Arthur when he was back in his bare London flat. How he would say it, what stance he would take, if he would let his eyes dampen or just lift his chin stoically in the face of such maternal neglect. But then, in the kitchen, he came across a photograph of himself resting on the top of the fridge, blown up on a canvas frame as wide as his outstretched arm. He was about 6, standing on a table, blowing a huge snot bubble out of his nostril, while his mother lifted her fists in the background to cheer him on. She looked wild, ecstatic, with a mane of permed white blonde hair. And he, in his checked shorts and baggy jumper, he looked like the king of the world. He had no memory of the scene or of who might have taken the photograph, but the warmth of it almost singed his fingers. He stood on the canvas frame until it snapped under his weight, feeling that she had set these traps on purpose, raising a hidden stick each time he attempted to wallow in her neglect. In a bar, on the outskirts of Roanoke, a waitress gives him a free old-fashioned when he tells her that his mother has died. "So sad, hun." She pats him on the back. "Try the buffalo sliders." He leaves her a large tip and waits half an hour, but she doesn't come to collect it. On the evening of his second last day in Virginia, he decided to finally tackle his mother's bedroom, a loft above the sitting room. He'd intentionally left it for last, expecting a gin's bottle of her thoughts and smells. One last chance for him to raise an emotion other than exasperation at her untidiness. But the room was frustratingly bare. The wooden floorboards were splintering in places and cobwebs infested the ceiling. As a child, Mark wasn't allowed to clear them for fear of disturbing the spiders, and had bashfully imported that habit to London. But besides that, the loft was tidy and stale. Her bed was neatly mazed on a raised stack of pallets, and the walls were grey stucco. A single light bulb was looped around a beam in the rafters, which were low and heavy. A mirrored full-length wardrobe sat in the furthest corner, and an uncomfortable-looking stool was arranged in front of a small window. On the roof outside, a bat box crouched under the eaves. He sat down on his mother's stool as dusk settled on the room. From it, he could see for a short distance across the darkening city, over apartment blocks and factories, and on the horizon, the frosty peaking of the Blue Ridge Mountains. Traffic sounds filtered up through the still air, under the soft twilight flittering of bats setting out to hunt. He stood up again after a few minutes, rubbing invisible dust off his hands, looking around the room for something to do. Something, anything to dismantle and throw away. Finally, he heaved the mattress off the pallets and wrestled it through the door, letting it slide down the stairs like a bobsleigh. The exertion left him panting, but he felt slightly better. He opened the door of the wardrobe and swung aside layers of bedsheets that hung like theatre curtains. In the back, there was a huddle of shapes and lines that caught in his fingers when he reached in to clear them. Something clanked and shifted in the dark. Mark stood back, sneezed a shower of dislodged dust into his elbow, and flicked on the dangling lamp. He pulled the sheets aside again, and the swaying light illuminated a set of jagged, gnashing jaws on a square metal head. A furred torso with limbs looped together on long, fine threads, still twitching at the elbows and knees where he had disturbed it. A stiff stick pierced the bottom of the mouth and made a hinge of the jaw, and a red felt tongue had been sewn into place. The terrible puppet had light bulbs for eyes with big red X's instead of pupils, and a tail that curled up and around its own neck. It was a crude and elegant thing, cobbled together from tin cans, carpet swatches and lengths of wood, and he couldn't be sure that it wasn't an accidental arrangement, an optical illusion, that if he moved his head the angle of the light would change and the simian face would return to being a collection of trash and old strips of fabric. A length of string dangled from the monkey's shoulders, and a piece of scruffy cardboard sat against its wire hanger ribs. Mark stared at this piece of cardboard, curled and edged at the corners. Then he began to laugh and laugh, startling a flurry of bats from under the eaves and out towards the mountain, because on the card was written his name.
Thank you, Jen. That was great. I really love this story. And a great reading there, because I know you have a sore throat. So tell me, how you first came across this story and why it stuck in your mind and, your experience with Sheila's writing generally.
Yeah, I first came across this story in Sheila's debut short story collection, which is wonderful and full of really quirky stories, which are what I'm always drawn to. And I guess the things I like about this story are the kind of juxtaposition of this very domestic, normal environment with something that you don't expect. Like the monkey appears from nowhere. Mm-hmm. And I also like the kind of circling round of the obsession. So these little flashbacks to the protagonist's lovers, they kind of appear dotted throughout the story. And at these points when he should be kind of caught up in other romantic moments, the monkey just keeps coming back. And I feel like that's quite often what happens with family problems and family issues for lots of people. You'd kind of try and push them aside, but they keep kind of resurrecting themselves. I know some of us were talking at the weekend and, you know, they were saying, you know, ask any writer about their mother and you just get an endless amount of material comes out.
We'll be on the podcast for 4 hours.
I mean, most people don't have monkey issues with their mothers, but I think this is very relatable, but also quite absurd as well. And I think that's probably what Sheila does best, that kind of juxtaposition of the absurdism with very relatable scenarios.
Yeah. I like the kind of, you know, the family mythology. We all have these stories in our families that, you know, they get bigger as you tell them and they take on this sort of like outsized importance. And you can even see that, of course, this is a story he tells to all his partners and things because he can't help himself, you know?
Yeah, and there's so much white space in this story. Mm. I mean, things that really annoy me about pieces of prose fiction are when it feels like the writer is trying to tell you what to think. Mm-hmm. And I think Sheila's been deliberately obtuse here, where we don't really know what the monkey in the cupboard represents at the end. Mm. We don't really know whether the mother loved the monkey more than her son. There's all sorts of kind of questions and things that are left up in the air, and that makes for a very satisfying read because it invites you in to fill the gaps in.
Totally. I really agree with you about the white space, and I really think that that's something I look for in a story as well, where it feels like you're allowed to come to your own conclusions a little bit and it doesn't feel like the writer is forcing anything upon
you.
Something I really enjoyed about this was how she handles time. You know, it moves so fluidly between, you know, giving a kind of context of the mother's background in the jungle and then the conversations between the partners. It seems very kind of natural, but it's very hard to do that.
Yeah, and we're actually covering quite a big span of time here because there are moments where he goes back to imagine his mother's life in the jungle before he was born. Mm-hmm. And we get this kind of the snapshots with all of the different lovers. For me, kind of most of it circulates around the mother's death and he's home for the funeral and to clear out her apartment. So there is a kind of like concrete place to snap into, but she does move masterfully through all of these different kind of time zones.
Yeah, no, she does. I really think that she sets up very well the sort of disparity between the kind of wild mother and then the, you know, he says he took a very kind of comfortable job, you know, he doesn't seem to put himself outside his comfort zone so much. And I really do feel that that's such a, you know, she doesn't dwell on it, but it's such a thing that, you know, I'm going to be different to my parents. And even if your parents were wild or whatever, you're like, I'm going to be far more straightforward. I'm going to achieve everything in a really straightforward manner.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, that's always interesting to me when you get these kind of, I mean, it's not really a narrator here because it's in the third person. But when the focused protagonist is less interesting than the person behind. Mm. So like kind of like the Great Gatsby thing, where you've got this very bland narrator who's putting attention on Jay Gatsby, who's a much more kind of complex, interesting character.
Yeah.
That's really hard to do because, you know, our entry point is through this chap's eyes. Mm-hmm. But what you really want to know about is this mother figure who's been to the jungle, who disappears on these little adventures all the time, who keeps this weird monkey robot in a cupboard. Mm-hmm. And you have to be quite controlled, I think, as a writer, not to let that run away from you.
Yeah, totally. And not to let her kind of turn cartoonish either, you know?
No.
Like, I think the elements of her life that she picks out, like her home and even the kind of image of her being in the supermarket before she kind of died and all of that, it seems very like a just very human.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And again, I mean, that I think is where you use the white space a lot, where you drop in a little scenario, a moment, an image, a metaphor, and you let it breathe rather than joining up too many of the dots. And Sheila's doing this really well in this story.
Mm. Do you enjoy stories about family dynamics?
I don't know if enjoy is the right word, Nicole.
I'm thinking of stories I just read about family dynamics. Yeah, I wouldn't call them enjoyable.
No, I seem to be drawn to them all the time. Yeah. And I do find something quite relatable about them, because most of us have a family experience of some kind, and most of us, it's relatively dysfunctional.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're all dysfunctional in different ways.
Mm.
So I do find that really intriguing. And I think there's just something weird about a family, in that this is a group of people you're supposed to have an incredible connection with, and yet it's the only group of people in your life you don't actually get to choose. And that is just quite weird.
It is, yeah.
So there's an absurdity there to begin with. And I think that's possibly why there's so many great plays and books that are looking at the absurdity of the family dynamic.
Mm. I really feel sometimes that, you know, when things are, I read a lot of John Cheever stories recently, and I can't stop talking about him, but I've just read one about a kind of family reunion, and this brother comes who isn't close to the rest of them. The rest are a kind of unit, and he comes back, and there's this sort of discomfort, and it's never stated plainly, but I think it really works for this story as well, because in family resentments, it's an accumulation of stuff. It's never just one thing. You never can be like, well, it was this incident, or it's not. It's all a feeling.
And I really love, and I tried to do it, and I don't know whether I pulled it off or not, but there's a scene in The Raptures where the family, a guy comes in to observe from the outside, and he's like, this family just really need to get drunk and yell at each other.
Yeah.
So I'm always drawn to those complex family dynamics where there's a subtext and it's not being spoken.
Mm.
And that seethes and it simmers and it festers eventually.
Mm-hmm.
But it makes for really, really interesting literature, because everything that comes out of the character's mouth isn't really what they want to say.
Yeah.
So you have to look into the spaces between the dialogue and the interactions.
Absolutely. And that's my favorite kind of dialogue as well, where there is so kind of, you know, the things left unsaid, or there's a little conversation happening.
Yeah, I mean, you do it really well.
I don't write books, Jan. I just host a podcast.
Oh, okay, sorry. We don't talk about our other lives in here.
No, straight podcast. No, I do. I really enjoy that kind of dialogue. And I even think the dialogue Sheila does here between the him and his partners, the people he's sleeping where he's clearly trying to, you know, impress them with the complexity and difficulty.
But what sort of a person tries to impress people with a weird, like, my mother might have loved a monkey more than me story?
And then he's getting undercut all the time by these people that are kind of, you know, correcting him. When someone sees your family dynamic outside you, they were just saying, they're like, well, that's strange. Or that means more than you think it does, or that means something else. That's not just a cute story. And I think she uses that really, really well.
Yeah, it's weird. I went to see May December, the new Todd Solondz film last night, and there's so much of that in it.
Yeah, I loved that film.
Julianne Moore's character, she's, you know, projecting one image of herself, and then her family can see, you know, behind the scenes there's so much else going on.
Yeah. And I think I'm always super impressed by stuff that can do that. When, you know, a character is outside the sort of main character.
I just thought the two of them, those are the roles I think they were, Natalie Portman and Julianne Moore, were made to play.
Yeah.
They're stone cold.
It's so tricky as well.
Yeah, but it's also quite funny. But you're like, why am I laughing at this?
I think there's really funny parts of the story too, particularly the bit with the waitress where he's like, my mother died. And it has that really kind of coldness that the world has in the face of grief, where, you know, your whole world and time stops, but everyone else moves on.
Yeah.
She's like, try the chicken sliders or whatever. And it's just like, yeah, of course. Like, no one else is going to feel for your mother what you felt for them, you know? That's such a sad thing.
Yeah. And I think as well, he doesn't really know what he feels about his mother.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely found out my dad died quite suddenly a couple of years ago. And the idea that people would have assumptions about how you feel when you lose a parent, automatically, and I did have a good relationship with my dad, but automatically people go, oh, you must be absolutely devastated. And I was thinking, for a lot of people, it's more complicated than that. And also, your base reaction might not be sadness. Like, mm-hmm. my base reaction often to grief is anger.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the first thing I want to do is go and smash stuff up mm-hmm. and throw things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, and that's why I love stories like this, that the human kind of responses feel more real.
Mm.
They're not cliches. They're not stereotypes.
Yeah, yeah.
Like when I read stories and people instantly burst into tears when someone, like something sad happens, I'm like, is that really how you feel?
I know there's so much of that, like that kind of cliche. Like, I watched a couple of things like where someone finds out they're being cheated on or being lied to and they throw up. Immediately throw up or whatever. I'm like, I don't think that happens in real life. You know, every feeling is so much murkier than
that. It makes me doubt myself. Am I having the wrong kind of emotional reactions to things? Because I'm not on the verge of tears all the time.
Yeah. I think that is something that a story can do, you know, when it's sort of ambiguity can show just how like confusing those feelings can be.
Yeah, and it's great to see, like Sheila does it really well. I'm thinking as well of like Otessa Moshfegh's work. Like her characters never have the kind of obvious emotional reactions, but they feel very valid, very believable.
Yeah.
And it's great to see more writers tapping into that because, well, it makes me feel more normal when I read stuff.
Oh, yeah, it's good. I think that's I think that's where I go to feel more normal. I'm like, oh, of course you felt that way.
Yeah.
I felt that way too. I really like that what Sheila kind of does with the place here, you know, that it kind of, it shows her life in the jungle and then his life in London, and I think he describes his apartment as strong lines and exposed wood. And you can picture it so clearly and you can picture his life. And it seems to be such a desperate attempt to like get away from the wildness and vastness of her life and make it so kind of narrow. And I think she captures that.
But I don't know if he picked up. There's a wee line where he talks about his apartment, you know, getting the floor stripped back and it's all minimal and great. And then he's like, but I never actually went home.
Yeah.
Like he travels to get away from it all the time.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I do that. Mm. And I really loved that line.
Yeah.
You know, I buy spaces, I make them nice, and then I constantly travel.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm not like, that was a part for me where I was like, that's so believable.
And it
makes me think as well that maybe there's more of his mother in the character than he wants to let on.
Totally. And I think that was the kind of unsaid thing that I think she was obviously like, you know, there is an adventurous side of him that he's almost trying to like tamp down, and she's just, somewhere lingering in the background, you know, every so often. It's like parents are like ghosts in a way, I think sometimes. Like sometimes I would say something and I'd be like, I sound just like my mother, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And you never intend to, but they're always there. I always try and write stuff without parents in it. And I've been trying to write.
How's that going for you, Nicole? Not very well.
Extremely badly, but they just show up, you know? They just turn up and I find that very
Why do
funny.
You think he smashes up the picture that he finds of himself? Because to me, that's one of the only parts of the story where he has this really lovely kind of warm like connection with his mum, that she's kept this cute picture of the two of them and they look really happy in it. And then he talks about he smashes it up.
I hadn't thought about that, but I guess, you know, maybe something about how idealistic the image is and how like it didn't correspond to their lives together or something that made him angry. But yeah, it's for such a short story. It contains, like I read it a couple of times, it contains so many, you know, different feelings.
Yeah.
And I'm always doing bring everything back to Cheever, but you know, how you can move into like, he could move into like a different mode of reality, like a different, you know, I think she does that really, really well in the story.
Yeah.
She gives a great description of how she wrote this story and where the idea came from. And it actually really added something for me. Often I read about how writers wrote their stories and it doesn't add something for me. But I wonder, could you read a little bit from the end of what she said?
Let me see. So, Sheila writes that Harry Harlow was famous for his work with racist monkeys in the 1960s. In one experiment, he would introduce something, a clanking, flashing, gnashing, primitive robot, and observe how the baby monkeys reacted. He found they ran to the soft cloth mother for comfort rather than the wire mother that provided food. This image of the robot stuck with me. You might recognise its cousin in the story. And I don't blame the baby monkeys for being frightened. The whole situation is disturbing, but there's something visceral about this work and other psychological experiments like Pavlov's dogs or Stanford Prison that breaks down relationships into digestible chunks that we can easily understand. You hear a bell, you get a treat. Authority makes people evil. Wire for sustenance, cloth for comfort. And then she talks a little bit about the ending of the story, which I think is quite interesting. And when the protagonist finds the monkey in the cupboard, and originally the card that was on the monkey, it just said, and on the card was written its name, like the monkey's name. And then she talks about how after she'd sent the first draft off, which is very familiar because as soon as you send the first draft off, you notice all the things you'd change. But she had this kind of moment of epiphany that she wanted to tweak it slightly and make it, and on the card was written his name, like the name Mark, which is the protagonist, and how that just sort of opened up the whole story. But what I think I like most about that is she sort of says she doesn't really know why it opens up the story, that she doesn't know what that means. And this is what she says. But why? Has his mother done this to make amends to the animal she left behind? Did she name Mark after the monkey in the first place? Was she trying to improve their relationship to exorcise this ghost that had haunted them both? Or, and I think I like this idea best, is the whole thing just a collection of random items that Mark is trying to pull meaning out of? And I think when I read that, I started to think about how many lists there are in the story as well. That there are multiple times when she lists possessions or she lists attributes in the room, things like that. And it's a piling up of kind of images without necessarily forcing any kind of meaning upon them. Mm-hmm. And I find that really satisfying.
Yeah, yeah.
The idea that the writer herself wouldn't really know what a story means at the end of it. Yeah. Like, that appeals to me a lot.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I also think that, you know, cataloging their stuff, like a person who's passed away stuff, like everything does take on this huge meaning that just wasn't there before, you know, and it's not just stuff anymore. It's all their belongings.
There's a sense of kind of trying to join the dots, like how do these six or seven items relate to each other to build up a consistent picture of who this person is when the reality is, it's just six or seven random items that maybe have no relation to each other. And I guess that's kind of what humans are sometimes. We're less easy to explain away. We're more complicated.
Absolutely. And, you know, I feel like you're always, I think, wanting to have a story. And I think she does this really well. Like the story of you and your mother and your life. And he repeats that story to all these people he, you know, he sleeps with or whatever to gain further intimacy with them, but the story isn't true, or it's not true on the level that he's telling it, or he doesn't understand it. And you can see her version of it as well, like, you know, she was a woman who was probably looking for work or looking for some kind of meaning and didn't want to just be confined to some these roles as like a mother or whatever. It's a great story. I really like that bit about her changing one word and it changing the whole story. Has that ever happened to you? Have you ever struggled over a sentence in that way? Particularly when writing stories?
I mean, that's the last line in this story. Mm. And I often, endings are what I find hardest.
Yeah.
And I often come back and the first version of an ending is usually too definite.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of in awe of this story because of how up in the air Sheila leaves it at the end. That's always what I'm trying to write. So I'll often come back and try and make the last couple of lines of the last paragraph a little bit more open.
Yeah.
Particularly with novels, like at the end of The Firestarters, it's really unclear whether Jonathan, the main protagonist, is going to cut out his daughter's tongue or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I deliberately left it like that. And I have readers all the time come up and say, well, did he? Because there is a certain kind of reader that wants clarity.
Mm-hmm.
And I just love going, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you think?
Mm.
Like, for me, as an artist, it's really nice to learn from your own work, to be surprised by it, to even be a little bit confused by it.
Yeah.
But I think you have to have quite a great deal of confidence that Sheila has here to be able to leave a story that upended where you can't really explain what this weird robotic monkey is and why it's got the same name as her son.
I think it's very difficult in your writing and in novels or stories or to acknowledge that some stuff is just meaningless.
Yeah.
Everyone wants things to have like a weight, and it's very emotionally honest in Sheila's story to just be like, well, it doesn't mean anything. Like, yeah. what did you expect it to mean, you know?
Or maybe it means something, but you don't know what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
I quite like that as well.
Mm. I think, you know, she's paying such attention on a sentence level that when she, I read that thing at the end about her changing the one word and it changing the whole story. It made sense to me because every sentence in this does feel like extremely considered.
Yeah.
And building to some kind of larger, building to the end, building to this kind of larger portrait between the mother and son. Can you talk to me about writing your own stories and how that came about and how you feel about writing stories?
I think short stories are the most nightmarishly difficult thing on the planet today. Give me a novel any day. I remember hearing Louise Kennedy say a wee while ago, I'm not writing any more short stories. They're just too hard.
Yeah.
I mean, I hope she doesn't do that because hers are brilliant. But short stories were what I came to first. So I'm entirely self-taught and I didn't really know any writers. I just read a lot. And when I first started writing in 2005, it just came out as these little small pieces of short fiction. And I feel my early attempts were really, really in awe of kind of a cross between Raymond Carver and Richard Brodigan, which is a very weird spot to land in. Yeah. Those are the two people that I really loved when I was growing up. And they've just kind of really developed over the last 15 years to have, I'd say, quite a recognisable style. Like I can see my own voice now. I think it's interesting to see, you know, you talked about always being drawn back to family.
Yeah.
There are themes that I tend to circle around. Dead children for some reason. I don't know why that is.
Just that happy
thing. Yeah. And lots of kind of fractured relationships across the generations. Not necessarily parent and children, but intergenerational kind of issues. So I think sometimes there can be something really satisfying about a short in terms of, you know, usually it takes me a couple of weeks to write a first draft when I've got a good idea.
Yeah.
A novel, you're looking at months and months and months. There's a collective eye rolling going on in the studio.
Yeah, I think that's something I enjoy about stories is that, it's an achievable.
Yeah, and do you know, I was talking to a poet friend about this the other day. Poets can be like, oh, look at that nice tree. Mm. What a lovely, very simple idea. I write a sonnet about it and forget about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like if we were to like be like, look at that lovely tree, I'll write a 100,000 word novel about it. So the short to me is a halfway house somewhere to park an idea.
Yeah.
And I also work in microfiction, which is even more good.
Yeah.
Even more good. That's a terrible sentence. Even better.
We're going to have to ask you to leave the podcast.
But it's even better for like those little small thought ideas. Like, I'm not sure what a novel looks like if it's just on one kind of very small concept.
Yeah.
It's possible. I'm sure it is possible to do that. But it feels like you need much more of a world to deliver it properly.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. And I think I sometimes struggle between knowing what is a story idea and what is a novel idea. Although I feel like I know it now. But sometimes I feel like when I approach a story, I'm in a far more like playful mood.
Yeah.
Like, because I'm like, well, you know, this one's for me, like 4,000 words or whatever that I can have fun doing.
And do you have a word count that you naturally just, because I've been trying really hard to write shorter, short stories, but 6,500 words, they always come in within about 100 words of that.
I always seem to gravitate towards longer stories, like 7,000, and sometimes even longer than that. Because it just expands, it gets bigger and bigger. Although I'm in awe of people who can write really like amazing short stories.
Yeah.
But there's something that I think, and I think Sheila does it here as well, that the short story accommodates, which is this sort of like, that the novel doesn't. But I'm thinking of how the time moves in this.
Yeah.
And then I'm thinking, you know, once again, of the Cheever story, The Swimmer, of how like absurd it gets in time and how you will fully accept that in a story. I don't think you will accept that in a novel, you know, that sort of jumping around, that confusion. You need like concrete.
Yeah, I think you'd have to be much more structured to pull it off in a novel. And I guess as a magical realist, the high absurdism you can pull off in a short story of a really bizarre concept.
Mm-hmm.
is much more deliverable when you're only trying to stretch it out over 6,000 words.
Yeah.
When it comes to delivering that as a novel, you get into the kind of backstory of things like, but why is there a dead grandmother in the closet? But, you know, why have all of the horses been like killed off? And you need a lot of exposition. In a short story, you can kind of just get away with, there's a dead grandmother in the closet.
And you must
get over
that.
With it. Like, kind of. So that's fun.
Can you talk to me about writing the stories in your new collection that's coming out next year? So obviously you've been working on it for a while, and it's, have you noticed anything has changed in your work since?
I think I'm a much more kind of concise writer than I was. So this would be my second like long short story collection. I've written a couple of microfiction collections, and some of my naivety, I think, has kind of been worn off by not just being published more, but also editing other people's work more. So in the interim, I have mentored quite a few people and I have edited an anthology, and I have thought a lot about sentences and tightening things up. So I think the stories in this collection are a little bit less flabby, maybe. It begins with one that I really like, which is, I think it's only 2,200 words long, and it's really dark, and it's very kind of concise. And I've been setting myself little challenges of trying to keep my sentences tight, trying to leave lots of white space. But I also, I really love the humor stuff. So there are bits where the dialogue just gets the better of you. Think, I'm going to give these characters a free hand.
I think that's like, that is true. And I also think that's very easy to do in a story where you're just like, people are funny, they're being funny on the page. Whereas in a novel, you're like, well, this doesn't work in the overarching tone of the... So that's a, like a struggle.
I also find when it comes to editing a short story, it's so, everything is so tight, so interlinked. It's almost like, you know, pulling a thread in a jumper and the whole thing starts to unravel. Whereas with a novel, it's much easier to lift a whole chapter or seven paragraphs out, and you can kind of sort of slide over it and fill in the cracks. I tend to be quite a dense writer. So every sentence needs to be there to kind of build it up. So I'm learning a lot about editing at the minute, and learning that editing is a creative thing as well as a terrifying thing. It makes me panic.
It does. It makes me panic. I think that I always say, you know, when I talk to and you've done lots of workshops and things yourself, but when I talk to younger writers and I talk about writing novels or stories, I really do think like stories are a great way to learn to write dialogue. Because you have so little space that that dialogue has to work. Like it has to reveal something. It has to mean something. And I really think that that, I don't know, it sharpens your dialogue. I really see it in the story.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I definitely have gone back and looked at writers whose dialogue is really tight. So people like Carver, who, I mean, there's no flab in a Carver short story, particularly the hard edited ones. Every sentence is there and it's doing double time. But also, I mean, George Saunders is a huge hero of mine. And I think Saunders isn't as tight in his dialogue. He allows his characters a bit more of a free hand. But what you do get with the dialogue is a real sense of the character developing. And he's amazing at bringing out the insecurities in his characters through the dialogue. That subtext we were talking about earlier, which I really love. And also he writes funny dialogue really, really well.
People are often very funny. That's the thing people forget. You know, I dislike very, you know, heavy dialogue because I don't particularly think Irish people speak like that. Like I don't, I think like, you know, it's very much like everything is underneath the surface of like what you're saying, of trying to say, you know. So I feel like the dialogue must reflect that in a way.
I just came up on the train listening to these two old boys sitting opposite me, and they talked about high-speed internet the whole way.
It's an issue.
But underneath it, basically, you could hear they were trying to ask, you know, how's your family doing and issues and that have been going on. And but the subtext was hidden by this massive discussion of how fast is your broadband.
Oh, it's so interesting. It's so, it really, if you do listen to people, it's like, it's fascinating in a way. I want to ask you, and I think George Saunders is a good segue into it, because you wrote a great essay about kind of the place of the imagination in fiction for The Stinging Fly. I think it was back in a few years ago. But I had what were you saying in that essay about the imagination? Because I don't think you were being like, oh, it should be about, you know, like science fiction or whatever. It's just about kind of expanding the what the characters can do or where they are. I think Saunders is a really brilliant example of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple of things. One, I think that sometimes people see the imagination as a kind of silly thing, yeah. and it's something that's not relevant to folks who write realist fiction. But every kind of creation of a character, every development of a scenario that isn't real, it requires imagination. Mm-hmm. And I guess I went through a really weird thing in 2015 where for the first time in 10 years of writing, I had no ideas. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it I realized was that it was my imagination was broken and I wasn't going out into the world expecting to see stories, to sit on a train with two fellas talking about broadband, but be able to see the story under it. And it's something that I think comes really natural to children. They see the world in this way where the stories are very obvious, but something happens to us as we grow up and that gets turned off.
Yeah.
So I've been trying to kind of pay more attention to that and to nurture it. And it gets a bit overwhelming because I know I walk down the street and I'm like, there's a story. That's a bit mad. So it's more being selective about what I want to tap into now.
Yeah.
So I think there is that. I think there's also a thing with, you know, realism has never felt enough for me. So there is an element of I'm always kind of pushing towards the absurd, the supernatural. But I've learned probably the hard way that to pull that off, you have to be a realist first. So you have to absolutely nail the development of believable characters in a realist sense before you can convince your reader that they can see the future or, you know, fly around the room of thing. So for me, looking at the kind of thin place between where does the kind of believability run out in a character? And that takes a lot of kind of imagination, but controlled imagination, which is again, back to Sheila's story. One of the things that I really like here, she has not lost the run of herself in this story.
It's very controlled.
And I'll be really honest, I don't read a lot of fantasy because it's too much for me. So things like The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and those kind of books are not me at all. But the kind of soft touch stuff where it tips into absurdism or the fantastical, but it's very grounded in realism, that's super interesting.
I think something I find sort of disappointing is that people feel, certainly like people starting out, a writer starting out and things and even beyond that, is that realism is the only way to reveal something. Like it's the only way you're going to get it at a truth. And I just don't believe that to be the case at all.
No, and I mean, if you look at I'm not a massive theatre goer, but all of the theatre that I do love is the kind of Beckettian of theatre where the absurd, the strange is used to get really deep below the skin of the characters and almost, you know, peel back the subtext we've been talking about and let us hear the roar, the howl that's going on underneath the surface. Yeah. And often I find there's no better way to do that than with the fantastical stuff.
Me too.
The super mundane stuff. And I also think it usually, for me, it works as a kind of metaphor. So yes, there is meant to be a dead grandmother in the closet, but she's also meant to represent something. So it's playing with those two levels of meaning. I mean, I've learned so much from the poets. The poets do this all the time. But it's not so common in kind of the traditional realist fiction.
Yeah, definitely not. And I think if you cut yourself off from that kind of imaginative space, you cut yourself off from like the imaginative possibilities for your characters, which is like it keeps them in a very limited, static one thing. And it's like, well, that's not really life, you know?
And it's not how, you know, if you think about how you move through life, you move through life experiencing what's actually happening, but your brain is constantly playing with the possibilities of this could happen next or I could have made this decision. So we are operating in several different realities at the one time.
You know, what's the DeLillo line? It's like there is a world within the world or something.
I'm getting very trippy for a Tuesday morning.
I really, I always think of one of the first stories that I thought about that did that for me. I remember I was in Tom Morris's first collection, and there's a girl at a party and she's come home from college and she's feeling a bit strange and weird. And
yeah.
And, you know, but the party is very normal. And then she moves through the party and then it ends with her like taking off her face, you know. And I was like, that is probably the closest kind of like metaphor you can get to like feeling like, you know, alienation or depression, you know, just like I'm not real and none of this is real.
Or do you know the John Patrick story where the horse walks
through
the party?
Yes, of course.
Which I thought about actually a lot when I was reading Shayla's story, because suddenly we have this horse appears out of nowhere, but it is kind of a signal in the absurdity of the situation.
Yeah,
like a horse could walk through your life at any moment and turn everything upside down.
Yeah. And it shows, you know, I think sometimes realist fiction implies that you have this sort of like level of control and dominion over your over your world. And I just don't ever believe that to be the case. So I've always
And do you feel that as a writer? Because when I, particularly with shorts, when I sit down to write them, I never really have any clue where they're going to go. Mm. So there is this feeling of kind of out of controlness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I enjoy that feeling.
I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And things can get out of control, like, you know, very quickly. I was going to ask you, of course, that about your essay about community. In the same thing. And I really loved that piece, Jan. Can you talk to me a little bit about it?
Yeah, it's a really fluffy piece.
We love fluff here on the podcast. It's now fluffy.
No, I think just, you know, my background was I came to writing quite late, and I came from a very fundamentalist religious background where art is not kind of, the sin is sinful. So I don't have that kind of support network that a lot of folks do. Mm-hmm. And the process of leaving that world, that community, was it running in parallel with the process of beginning to write.
Yeah.
So I think there was something about the writing that made me question and think, but also just a kind of leaving one community and looking for another community. Mm. And the community that opened up for me was the community of Irish writers. Mm. And I was just, I guess, blown away. I've said this a number of times by how gracious they were, because I did not come out of, you know, a fundamentalist religious background with all of the right politically correct attitudes. Mm. So there was a sense of being accepted as where you were and a work in progress and possibly a little homophobic, racist, sectarian and misogynistic.
Mm.
But people kind of loved me and accepted me and journeyed with me, and I hope I would not be quite as homophobic, racist, sectarian and misogynistic anymore.
It's great. I think when I read that piece, it felt very, you know, modern, and it felt very close to my own experience and like very far removed from this idea of the writer as, you know, in a garret, like lonely, isolated, which is not super my experience either. And also the idea of you not just as a writer, but like as a person moving through the world. Like I feel, you know, sometimes these people are quite like, oh, there shouldn't be writing communities or it's clicky or whatever. But I'm like, it doesn't feel clicky. It just feels like human to me.
I mean, I think it comes down to what is a community.
Yeah.
And a community to me is something that's always outward facing.
Yeah.
Like a clique is inward facing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you're holding the door open for the people who come after you.
Yeah, totally.
And that's something that was modeled to me. And I think, you know, particularly in the North, I think the likes of Seamus Heaney and some of the folks that he invested in, they then invested in me. So, you know, early people who looked after me and helped me were people like Sinead Morrissey.
Yeah.
And that makes you then want to go, well, here are the younger emerging writers who are coming after.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's also about seeing people holistically.
Yeah.
You know, we are writers. Mm-hmm. Probably this is sacrilegious to say in the Sting and Fly podcast, but writing is not the most important thing in the world.
You're going to have to go, Jen.
I know. People are humans too.
Yeah.
And bad things happen in their lives.
Yeah.
And you need, there's a line in that essay, which I think is probably the most important line, which says, not liking someone's writing doesn't mean you can't like them.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And I think we can have artistic differences and still support each other as human beings.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, absolutely. But I feel also like the idea that, you know, you wouldn't have any contact with any other writers, it would be so limiting. I mean, you're not talking to...
It's like those people who say they don't read.
Yeah, you're not talking, yeah, absolutely. Like, you're not talking to anyone else. Like, some of the conversations I've had have been so useful on the podcast and in real life, you know, for my own work. So I thought it was a really refreshing read.
I think as well, you get to set the boundaries. Mm. So like, I don't have a trio of writers or a workshop that I belong to that absolutely terrifies me and isn't helpful for my writing. But I know for some people, that's a great way to do artistic community. But I do have people that I have really structured conversations with about talking about a book or a poem, and that's very helpful for me. So I think it's finding out what works for you as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've taught a lot of workshops and things like that. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Do you know, I love teaching workshops, but I think of the last couple of years, I've been doing more mentorship and I probably like that better.
Yeah.
With a workshop, you know, you maybe have 14 people for a few hours and you jump into their life and their work and then you jump out again.
Yeah.
Having a consistent year with an emerging writer to look at their work progress, to learn from them. Like, I know it's a kind of a truth universally accepted that it's easier to pick out mistakes in somebody else's writing than your own, but it really tightens up your own editorial skills. And I've been so, so lucky. I've had some incredible emerging writers to work with. So I'm kind of more veering towards the mentorship stuff at the minute. It suits me. I get a lot from it. I have loved everybody that I've worked with so far.
Yeah, that's so great. And can I ask you as well, so you're talking about writing short stories, and was there any kind of particular Irish short story writer or that really expanded the possibilities that you were like, oh, I can do this now, or I will look at things differently?
Definitely Kevin Barry.
Yeah. I think a lot of people say Kevin,
I think there is a kind of irreverence about Kevin's writing that I really love. And it's not got a strict adherence to realism. And I love that. And obviously his dialogue, his humour, like, to me, I hadn't seen that anywhere except in American writers until that point.
Yeah.
And it was great to be like, oh, you don't have to be American. And I just also love, like, Kevin feels very homegrown. He's not taught. His work doesn't feel like it's come out of an MFA program or a formula. It's very of him. I remember the first time I ever read with him, I was so terrified. And he was so, so lovely and gracious and encouraging.
Yeah.
But I think he's amazing.
Yeah. And I know what you mean. His writing, that is also something that I gravitate towards, that it doesn't feel formulaic.
No.
You know, it doesn't feel like this paragraph slots here, this paragraph slots here. You know, it's a little bit more unruly than
that. I think it's about having the balls to be yourself and not to be looking around going, what are publishers wanting at the minute? What is trending at the minute?
Yeah.
What's the story that you actually want to write and how do you want to write it?
Yeah.
And I, like, there are trends and things that kind of sweep through the publishing world. And I think we need to be a bit more ballsy about saying we're not going to play to the publishers. We actually get to write the stories the way we want to write them. And if no one buys them, that's all right.
Well, trends come and go, you know, they pass, you know. I do feel as well, that Kevin was very good at doing that kind of like humorous thing that we were just talking about, the, you know, the unexpected.
Yeah.
I remember a couple of his stories being like, that did not go where I expected it to go.
There's a writer, and not a lot of people know him, his work's coming back into print, called Ian Cochran.
Oh, I don't know.
So Cochran was from Cullibaggy, which is a wee village up near Ballymena. And he wrote really irreverent, dark, humorous kind of books about working class Protestants in the 70s and 80s. Like, one's called Jesus on a Stick. And they, like, they're very critical of the unionist community. They're darkly humorous. They're amazing. Now, they're not entirely politically correct. There's definitely a lot of misogyny going on. But the language in them is just amazing.
Yeah.
So Turnpike, I think, are reissuing a lot of those. And they are really worth... For me, that was huge, to find somebody from the same place as me, who talks like me, who's obsessed with the same kind of themes. It came a bit later than Kevin, but it was really encouraging to find that.
I think that's a real true thing when you find, like, that is something I felt when I first read Kevin Barry or Colin or whoever, that I'm like, oh, I know all these people. I know exactly like who they are, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a very satisfying thing, because the Irish short story can be like quite daunting in a way, can't it? Like the thought. Like,
do you think it's a good thing to be an Irish writer, or it's a big weight to sit under?
Oh. I you know, because I wrote a non-Irish novel, you know.
I mean, that was very bad of you, Nicole.
That was really, I'm going to be expelled. But I think I've gotten this question a lot this year, and I don't know. I feel like it's a good, it's like everything. It's like a good and bad thing. Like I feel.
I was just doing my three books of the year for the Irish Times last night, and none of them are Irish. I was like, oh no, people are going to run me out of the country.
It's the last straw.
One's actually in translation.
Oh my God. I was going to say to you, Jan, we don't have much time left. So I'm just going to ask you very quickly, have you read Sheila's novel? Yes, Falling Animals.
I have, yeah. I actually blurbed it. So my name is in the front of it, so I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah, it's a great book, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
I'm recommended here. Well, that was brilliant. Thank you so much, Jan. Thank you for your time. And a big thank you to Jan for joining us for the podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it. If you're new to the podcast, please subscribe. We'll be back in the new year with another writer reading a story from the Stinging Fly archive. Access to the Stinging Fly's full archive is available to everyone who subscribes to the magazine and to our patrons. Taking out a subscription is a great way to support what we do. Subscribe at stingingfly.org. I want to thank the Arts Council, who provide funding for this podcast, and for everything else that the Stinging Fly is doing to seek out, nurture, publish, and promote the very best new writers and new writing. Thank you for listening, and happy Christmas!